of a millimeter, a cubic millimeter, and it could be not exactly what we think of soft tissue, but something that can be kind of meshed and solvated, dissolved and heated and turned into something. So I still think there's a possibility, but we kind of have to downsize the discovery a great deal, because most people let their imagination really far.
Bill, there seems to be some interference, but if I may, Roy?
Yeah, well, I mean, we'll have to talk around. I don't know what to tell
you. Yeah, Roger. But, I mean, it brings back the kind of ideas about Jurassic Park, and, you know, if we can just dispel that sort of mess up. And the, you know, the degradation rates, just to put a final kind of, like you said, you're not going to find a full chicken or a dinosaur or DNA that's even remotely respective of any sort of biological matter as we know it.
I always like to keep it open mind, but as I frequently say, if you keep it too open, your brain will fall out. People tend to kind of fantasize on things that would be really keen, and so we have Jurassic Park and other such things. But, you know, if you keep your expectations microscopic, you can still have a couple of little bit of wiggle room. It might be completely disproven, or it might not. I understand your skepticism. I share your skepticism to a great degree, and I kind of like to keep limitations on people's flights of fancy.
Absolutely. By all means, let's carry on. But the rate of DNA degradation is sufficient to obviate any sort of usable material, even if it was preserved, even if there was some sort of router mechanism. But yeah, I do agree. If we don't keep our minds flexible enough to accept new discoveries, they just whisk right by us. And that's how we get too fixated on the hypothesis and we decide that that's what the answer is going to be. We never actually recognize the fact that the data deviates from that in some regard. So, therefore, careful experimentation. AC2PL, thank you, Roy, for that. I will turn back to you and Wes.
Something. thank you for just able to entertain you guys. Los Angeles Times is definitely not a scientific journal, although it has a science and medicine section, and it uses some form of credibility, pointing at Mary H. Schwaber, paleontologist at North Carolina State University. He's also giving something that you both of gentlemen, you might laugh from, but that, let me say. It says, the translucent vessels were so elastic that when one was stretched out and then released, it snapped back like a little rubber band. Back to you, Dr. Roy.
Okay, but I think it was still processed. It isn't like they just kind of found it on the edge of a rock someplace. They exposed it to a bunch of chemical agents to degrade the surrounding material and free whatever it is that they found. And again, it might indicate something, but it might not. You know, there's a lot of smuts in the crust of the earth. So I wouldn't kind of just say if it's springy, it has to be organic in origin. You know, there are a lot of interesting chemical processes that the Earth manifests.
Yeah, so Schweitzer and her colleagues first raised that question after they examined the T-Rex in 2005, and they, of course, it is seemingly impossible. But they found in plenty of other remaining of the bones presence of the tissue. But from the article that I have right now, I cannot say if it's a soft tissue or it's not. But anyhow, the presence of iron is everywhere. So what is the role of the iron, Dr. Roy?
Well, it depends. It could be a mineral deposit, or it could be hemoglobin, or something that's proto-hemoglobin.
Okay, so the iron that we have in our body is present in our bones?
Well, that's a strange way of putting present in our bones. In our bone marrow, yes. Bone marrow is where blood production often takes place, and that's where the iron is hooked together with the globulin molecules, the chelating metal, and so there's lots of hemoglobin in bone marrow. You know, in some vascular bone tissue, it also is, because it's in each blood cell, red blood cell, but there's lots of it in bone marrow.
Okay. So Lucy was found November 24, 1974, at Hadar, Ethiopia, and was taken to the quite thorough examination, and they found that Lucy was 3.4 feet tall. She was fully grown young female who died at a young age. And they also found some sort of the disease, but that disease wasn't really related to her death. The evidence strongly suggests that that material from East Africa belongs to one and single the animal, which actually are the human being later on. So we're talking about 3.2 million years ago that we've been in that stage. And now we have a last 200 years of evolution. So the Lucy is like we've been between all of the Homo-like species. That was the one that survived. They were fighting between themselves. Some of them had even the higher brain, bigger brain than the others, but Lucy survived. Okay, so right now we have a 200 years of evolution. Everything is changing to the point that we are the first species in the planet Earth who use computers, who use radio waves, who use gasoline and energy. There was a time a few years ago when I contacted mathematicians from Hunter College, and I asked them if the energy was for free, how long do we have? And one of them say, yeah, you know what? It's a funny thing. Okay, so after that I've got a phone call. 18 years. I say, what 18 years? If the human being had today energy for free, all energy for free, it will multiply right now to the point that 18 years from now, the overpopulation starts to be visible. So your daughter would be born today, would be 18 years old when the overpopulation hits. As I assure you, but that's numbers. That's not reality. Dr. Roy.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully that Thurston was just joking with you, because it sounds like the dumbest thing I ever heard. Cheap or expensive energy is just one of many factors that determines whether people reproduce. I think if you gave people free gas and electricity, the population of the United States would not suddenly quadruple. People would spend all of their energy using, I guess, sex devices in the bedroom, reproducing. I don't know. It's a stupid concept, stupid idea, and hopefully the guy was just kidding you. I just want to kind of go back and recheck something. You seem to kind of give the indication that different branches of hominids killed each other until the winners of the Great War survived. Again, that's a real simplification of a concept. Go much further in evolution. Our cousins were the Neanderthals. We come from a common ancestor, the two Homo sapien and Neanderthal kind of branched out from an earlier hominid. We did not kill all of the Neanderthal. If you ever kind of check in these genetic websites where you can spit into a vial, they'll tell you what percentage of Neanderthal genes you possess. Sometimes we starved them out, sometimes we killed them, and sometimes we had babies with them. So, again, life is really much more complicated than we just killed everyone.
Okay, yeah, so coming to your comments. Yes, you're right. We both know that the question is absolutely stupid. We both weren't serious. But from a mathematical point, everything could be calculated. So remember, we're joking and saying that China allows right now to have two children instead of one, and 1.6 billion people in China alone, then add on top of it India, Pakistan, what do you have, 6 billion people? I'm not sure. I'm sorry, I'm just taking it out of my head. So... And then you say, okay, just think that everybody has a food because of it. You have some guy in Sahara who just all of a sudden has the electricity, and heck, they can do whatever. They don't care how much it costs. Taking the seawater and make it fresh water, drinkable water, because it's for free, right? Okay, so we went to that kind of humoristic conclusion 18 years from now, and there is a start of overpopulation. It's not end of the world, it's a start of overpopulation, because everybody is happy, just lambada and dance. When I finished joking, we had a discussion about a headset, Dr. Roy, and actually it happened that you have the same headsets that I have. I have two of them, and thank you for the explanation. But I would like you to say a little bit more over the radio. Back to you.
Okay, it's kind of a happenstance that we discovered this. I was looking for a high-quality, very lightweight headset. I came across this guy who imports them in from Japan. They come in two versions. One of them has a dynamic microphone, and one of them has a condenser. Right now, I'm using one of them to communicate. It's plugged in to an audio input that's plugged in to my computer that's plugged into AllStar. Nice headsets, ridiculously expensive. I think 9 out of 10 hams would hear the price, and they'd say, you're a crazy man. The guy who imports it, a little bit crazy. He refuses credit cards. He prefers cashier checks. He will tolerate personal checks, but he will not send you any of your order until the check is completely cleared. So he's a little peculiar. But very good headsets. I love them intensely. I had to get some replacement foams, which were also ridiculously overpriced. But I just like these headsets a great deal, and I have both of them. The other one is hooked up to my ICOM IC7100.
Okay, there was a story into it, and I've read it, but I know it's true. I don't know if it's true, because there was a lot of rumor in ham radio over it. So, they were Japanese, they were faulty, not allowed to be sold. And actually it was found that for the purpose of ham radio, they were excellent. Dr. Roy.
I don't know. I never really heard that rumor. I just assume that because of the price point of these things, the Japanese manufacturer didn't want to be bothered with dealing with marketing outside of Japan. There's a lot of things that are just local to Japan that the companies don't bother to market it. Even international Japanese companies have, Seiko, I think, has certain brands of watches that they only sell in Japan. So my assumption was that this was a brand that had a high price point, and the manufacturer was only interested in selling it locally. And this guy, Jay, had a connection and was able to import them into the country and sell them individually by himself. It's a really kind of a small outfit. It's not like it's a major company. I think he's probably totally retired.
The faultiness of them was actually due to the narrow characteristic of the frequency for the microphone. So let's say we do not use 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz in ham radio, and there are certain frequencies that are pretty good for single sideband, Dr. Roy.
Well, I mean, I'm using it, I was using it on FM at once upon a time. I don't know exactly how you would describe what I'm doing now. All-Star, I'm sure, has some kind of audio filtration system. So that wasn't really my interest, although when you buy these headsets, they actually give you an audiogram of the signal for the different frequency sweep. So it's very nice. The thing I liked about this is it's very comfortable to wear. It's very lightweight, and yet it's very, very sturdy. You know, sometimes you can get a flimsy, lightweight headset. Something better to do? Well, why don't you go and call a special officer? It makes me even tingle even for 4th of July again. Anyway, how are you, Wes?
Of course. Those headsets were used because of that quite interesting frequency of the microphones. And that's why the Japanese company didn't allow them to be sold on the market. And our friend Ham Radio Operator found out that he could make a buck on it, and everybody was happy. Back to you, Dr. Ray.
Well, you know, the people willing to spend that amount of money, I guess, were happy. I don't know. You can sell these things to ham radio operators all over the world. Heil does it all the time. You know, Heil's microphones are kind of matched for single sideband and such, so it's certainly doable. Not all headsets have to be open to the entire spectrum. You can have a somewhat more constricted for SSB, AM, or FM and such, so I don't know if that's the reason why. Again, I think it's just because they didn't want to market it outside of Japan. It's a lot easier to sell inside the country you live in than to set up dealerships and distribution centers. You know, I mean, for the people who make expert systems linear amplifiers, one I own, you know, it's it probably is a pain in the backside because they're located in Italy, and they really don't have access to the rest of the world, so they set up distributorships. And these distributorships just seem to have a lifespan of about 5 years, and then they have to find another one, and then they have to find another one, and then they have to find another one. So, you know, some companies say, I'm more than happy with the profit I get from Japan and settle with it there.
Yeah, okay. So, in the meantime, I found Lucy was only 60 to 65 pounds for 3.5 feet. Tall, and now we have a 3 years old girl at approximately 3.5 feet. So, what made the human animal to grow that tall, Dr. Roy?
Survivability was better as you got taller to one degree or another, and also it's nutrition. If you have better nutrition, you tend to grow a little bit taller with the same exact genetics. So it's probably a combination of factors like most animals. Did you hear my last transmission?
We did, Roy.
Okay, good. Wesley?
Yep. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, I mean, again, evolution works its magic little way. There are some mutations that lead to somewhat shorter animals, others longer. If they're in an environment where being taller is more productive to survivability and the capability of reproducing, then those evolutionary forces will manifest a higher percentage of those tall genes being passed down through the generations until it becomes detrimental, and then that force on evolution will stop, if not reverse itself. So, again, it's an ongoing, complicated process. It has no consciousness. It has no plan for the future. It simply goes along with the environment. And if you take one animal and put them in a completely different environment, the traits that optimize their survivability might change, and their route through their evolution might change dramatically.
The last question that I have is to Paul and to you, Dr. Roy, and eventually anybody else who is willing to respond. Our science gave us tools to see approaching asteroids, and eventually we hope that we'll be able to prevent any other impact of bodies that would like to hit our planet Earth. But the question is how prepared we are. And what did we do to that? And eventually, did we do anything? Is Paul available?
Still here.
Dr. Roy, can you rephrase my question?
No, I heard that word.
Okay.
Yeah, well, you know, we've been looking for things coming our way for probably decades. And there's a couple of new ones that they're looking at. There's one called Sentinel that I'd like to see them get up in orbit around the sun. It would be about 1 million miles in front of us. Earth would be following the Sentinel satellite. And Sentinel would be looking out away from the sun. So as it goes around 365 days, it'll be looking out. So it'll be looking north and south as well. But it'll be looking out for any incoming comets or asteroids. you know, comets would tend to be coming from the pole area, and asteroids would be coming from the ecliptic. But that hasn't been, you know, completely funded yet. But that one I thought would be great. It's the pet project of Rusty, I forget his last name. The astronaut, he was on Apollo 9, he only had one flight, but his goal is to actually get a satellite like that up in space. That's one I would like to see, but, you know, there's been other ones, there's plenty of Earth observation satellites looking up. Some of the ones that they use are radio astronomy. They'll look for something and try to figure out what it is, if it's coming our way. You know, they say that it's like, I don't know, 85 or 90% of the stuff that's near Earth asteroids, NEAs, near Earth asteroids, have been cataloged, and so we've got like another 10 or 15% to go that are over, you know, a certain diameter, a couple hundred feet. Now, I think if it gets to feet or more or something, it becomes a catastrophic event if it hits the Earth. But that's roughly what I know about it. It's a work in progress, that's for sure. Look what they did with the DART program. Where they hit the one asteroid with crashed into it to change its timing, for going around the sun. So, you know, there's plenty of work being done now in that respect, too. What happens if we see it? Can you stop it? Back to you, Roy.
Rusty Schweikart.
My two cents, AC2GS, is that they're all working on it. They're not good at it right now. Hopefully, eventually, they'll be much, much better. Exactly what weapons do we use to divert it to someplace else? It depends a lot on how early we can detect it. The farther away we can detect it, the less powerful weapon we can deflect it with. So it's in the midst of being worked on, and probably will be worked on for the centuries to come.
Yeah, Russ, I get Schweikart, I think. But yeah, that was his pet project.
Yeah, there's a C before the K.
Yeah, that's what I have, but. Anyway, he went up with McDivitt and Scott, Apollo 9. They checked out the LEM. They checked out the Apollo, in Earth orbit. And he got back, and he never took another flight, but he was been obsessed with near-Earth asteroids hitting the Earth, neo-sequel. So, he's got to be getting close to 90. I think all those people were born in the 1930s. He's got to be up there.
Yeah, he was born in 1935. He's 88 years old.
Okay, yeah, that's what I figured. Yeah, most of them were all in the 30s in the Apollo era.
Yeah, he's called Rusty, obviously, because he had red hair. He really had red hair.
Yeah, at his age, maybe. I wonder if he still got hair. I don't know. I haven't seen a picture of him in probably 10 or 20 years. Probably 20 years ago when I saw the report about the Sentinel satellite he wanted to put up. He tried to get funding for it. And, all he needed was a couple hundred million dollars. Which I think would really be worth it.
Well, you should have gone to some sortie.
Oh, yeah. who knows? He was trying to get NASA to get the funding. I guess that's what it was. You know, not himself.
Well, I can understand why, but, you know, it's a shame. I mean, the Saudis tried to waste billions of dollars on, I don't know if you're familiar with, I think they call it the line. It was going to be a kind of just a long line of building complexes. It was supposed to be something like a kilometer or two. I think they kind of settled it down to be something much shorter.
That's what happens when you give one group all the money from the fuel. You know, they'll be the first ones with the flying cars, I guess.
No, I was just going to point out that they have things that they call flying cars. They're basically just planes that they can kind of drive down a road to one degree or another. But, you know, unfortunately, when you can afford to buy anything, you buy anything. So, it's a wonder, you know, not the Saudis, but I think Abu Dhabi or some other country are just filling up the coast waters with artificial islands and trying to build real estate on it. So it's the 21st century has demonstrated an interesting experiment of what happens if you give not very clever people a ridiculous amount of money to spend. What do they spend it on? They don't spend it on food and medicine for the poor. They spend it on fake islands.
Yeah, I know a couple of people are building rocket companies too as well.
Well, I think it's a better investment to build rockets than Jeff did with his super yacht. He built a yacht that was so big that it needed a smaller yacht to take care of the bigger yacht.
Yeah, I'm surprised they don't have their own submarines as well. Somebody's got to do that, a commercial submarine. I'm surprised I haven't seen that yet.
I think the problem is you can't show it off that well. Most of it's underwater. So, you know, what's the joy for that? You know, they want to preen with it. They want to, you know, show you what they got. So if most of it is underwater, you know, any old guy can kind of put some kind of a couple of pipes together on the surface and say that there's a massive, $200 billion submarine right below that pipe there.
Okay, very good.
Yes, so
United Arab Emirates, they have a satellite around Mars. It's called HOPE. They actually put the satellite together, but they paid to have it launched. They didn't launch it themselves, you know. But, this is what they're doing, you know. they also give away money to politicians, billions of dollars, not millions, but billions, you know. So, you know, interesting places. I've never been there, but I have no desire to go there either.
Yeah, I have a question.
Wes, Frank wanted to say something. You know, Frank's on Echo Link, so we kind of block him completely out. So let's drop the repeater for a couple of seconds and give Frank an opportunity.
Yeah, you forget, there was the guy who built his own submarine, the Titan, to take a couple of people down to visit the Titanic. And I think they had a little problem with it.
Yeah, I thought of him, but that's a different thing entirely, I think. That's a mixture of hubris and greed. He thought that he could somehow put together something with scotch tape and glue and build it into a company worth $1 billion because he came from, you know, five generations of filthy rich people and he hadn't really done anything useful in his life. So I think that was a little bit different than these these weird ideas that sheiks have to kind of build a massive futuristic city in the middle of a desert that where the ambient temperature is 120 degrees Fahrenheit.
Yeah, besides, that was done once before. It's called Las Vegas. So I'm not quite sure there's anything that unique about that. Or for that matter, some of the Israeli cities, and maybe the UAE itself. Go ahead.
I mean, if you ever have nothing better to do, you know, YouTube search, I think it's called The Line, and it's been vastly downscaled in the last few years, but it was a ridiculous white elephant. I had never seen such a poorly thought-out project in my life, so no one in their right mind would build this thing, and so these guys probably weren't in their right mind, but... You know, their ego is the first thing that they deal with. But as the days go on, the line shrinks to a smaller and smaller project. And, you know, by the time it finally gets built, it'll probably be an outhouse.
Yeah, I did hear about that project. But, you know, that's the nature of startups. A lot of them start up, and they just... kind of run out of money or turn out to be fraudulent or whatever. But Elizabeth, what's her name, probably in your wheelhouse, the lady who was the phony blood testing company, WB2BX.
AC2GS. Yeah, Elizabeth Holmes, she's in jail. But this was not a con. This was a legitimate thing because the Saudi wealth fund has hundreds of billions of dollars of assets. So if they wanted to start on this project, I don't think they could finish it because I think it would have cost more than even they had in funds. But it wasn't a scam. It was just an act of intense hubris on the part of a very, very, very wealthy sheik. I think it was quoted as being, as costing something reasonable, you know, like $500 billion, but as time went on, it started to look like it was going to cost $3 or $4 trillion. And again, the Saudis got a lot of money, but they don't have that kind of money yet. So it just kind of fell apart.
Somebody was texting. My phone kept beeping. He's talking about in the desert or the blood testing company.
I was talking about both, but primarily the city in the desert was not a con. It was a under budgeted, absurd dream come true for people who had control over hundreds of billions of dollars of assets and could spend them without anyone checking anything.
Yeah, well, don't get me started on what I think of the Saudis, but what should I say? They have more money than Allah?
Well, that probably would be perceived as blasphemous on some people's mind.
Okay, I'll take that back. I'll just say they have more money than God.
Yeah, people who talk about God tend not to threaten to kill too many people these days.
What about that, Roy? But point well taken. Anyway, yeah, what I find amusing is these Russian super yachts operated by their oligarchs, some of which I think have been confiscated, but their naval vessels are so badly built when they cross the Atlantic they have to be followed by a fleet tug because they almost always break down.
Well, I mean, thankfully, Russia is a, it's really, I don't consider it an oligarchy, I consider it a kleptocracy. There was an episode of Star Trek in which a planet was left a book of the history of Mob Chicago, and they mirrored it, they took it as the Bible type of thing, and they reorganized their planet like a Chicago mob area. So Russia is a mob. It's a kleptocracy. It's a bunch of thieves and scoundrels, and they're basically skimming from the top in the middle and the bottom. So my guess is their nuclear weapons don't work anymore because you have to maintain them. They don't last forever. And they basically ruined a lot of their military weapons were either sold or left to rust. And what they want for themselves, they take. But for the common good, only a chump would do that. So fortunately, that's the reason why Ukraine is doing reasonably well. They're fighting a country that basically ruined their military stockpile.
Yeah. There is 565,000 of Russians presumably dead on the Ukraine soil since the beginning of the war in 2022. So how many thousands per day?
Well, but I mean, that's the problem with Russian strategy. This is very common Russian strategy that you throw, it, when you run out of bullets, you throw human bodies at the problem. And if there's one thing that Russia still has for the time being, it's warm bodies. So they have an almost endless supply of them. A lot of young Russian people are trying to escape every which way. But there's only so many ways you can do that. So it's a shame for both the Russian people and the Ukrainian people, and just for the sake of petty bureaucrats and military idiots and thieves and scoundrels in Moscow. It's a pity on everyone.
Okay, I would like to prop it up, this object, with some comment and some question. So it looks like, based on what Paul told us, and at least my knowledge, and what I understand is taking place right now, is we are able to be aware of some incoming asteroids that may end our life. But we do not have any solid form of defense or ability to save ourselves till now. There are a few hypotheses that we may reflect, whichever word we use, the course of the asteroid that eventually change our life or life of the planet. But the sad thing is that for the first time, I mean, that Earth had, imagine, if I understand it properly, somebody think I'm wrong, okay, fine. So we have the first extinction. We have a 10% of the species left. Some of them had horns, some of them had plates, some of them had whatever armory on the body, bones, standing, a hammer at the end of the tail, humongous one to damage another predator, and then what? Okay, and then we have a 10% of that. That 10%, after first extension, was the 100% of whatever was left. And then from the 10%, 90% extinct. And then we had a 5 of them. And then at the end of the 5th one, from the 10% that was left over, we have one species, which is the human animal. Human being that is now, for the first time in history of this Earth, able to use radio waves, able to use the science, able to use computers, do things that no one of the creatures ever was able to do. But at the same time, according to another science of brain, we use only 10% of our brain. What would be if we use 20? And of a sudden, we are defenseless. We cannot defend ourselves. We may know that half a year from now, something may hit the Earth. 1 year from now, something may hit the Earth. And we don't know what to do. Dr. Roy, am I wrong?
Well, for some things, yes. The line about we only use 10% of our brain is unfortunately an incorrect thing that got promoted and spread around, and a lot of people think that. We don't use 10% of our brain. We use 100% of our brain. Comment was based on nonsense. The extinction events, you know, they might have killed 90%, but that's not a kind of a static thing. Life fills in the empty spaces, and so you had an extinction event, and then you had a growth, a spurt of different types of life forms trying to fit into each of the niches that were left empty, and then you had the extinction, and you had it happen again, and you had the extinction, and it happened again. I read an article that theorizes that hypothesizes that at some point only 1,000 hominids were left in the population, and billions of us derived from that minuscule little thousand group of hominids. So, and you know, the fact that we've gone so far doesn't mean that we're godlike. There's a lot of things that the Earth could kill us in a minute with. There's a lot of things that the galaxy could kill us, and a lot of things that the universe could kill us. We're still just a mote in God's eye. So although you might feel that we're much more powerful than that, we're not. You know, the last time we had an earthquake in Brooklyn and Queens, I certainly felt it.
Me, there was plenty of people who felt it. And it was quite scary. Back to you.
Yeah, so, I mean, ultimately, we are frail biological systems. You know, our line might survive, variations off of our line might survive, but we may perish. You never know. You know, you take a look at that stairwell that Stefan mentioned earlier tonight, and we're just a fraction of our lovely little universe, an inconsequential one. The rest of the universe really wouldn't give a damn if we ceased to exist this very second. You know, no Alpha Centaurian would cry a tear at our loss.
I wonder, Paul, do you have an ending comment?
Not much in the philosophy section. You know, I kind of like reality and history and what we could do in the future. You know, I think more like a mechanic. You know, how are we going to get to whatever we're going to be doing? What kind of equipment are we going to be using? What kind of rockets are we going to use? You know. So, no real comment along this line, Wes.
It looks like guaranteed at the end. Thank you very much for the discussion.
Well, thank you, Wesley. As always, I appreciate your participation. So, once again, I continue to be AC2GS. This continues to be the Limoc Technical Net. We do have a little bit more time if anyone is so inclined. If anyone has a question or a comment or a topic for discussion, please hit that push to talk. Okay, it seems to be that everyone sort of talked out for the night. I'm more than willing to quit a little bit early, but I'll give you guys one last chance. If anyone has any questions or comments or closing comments to this segment, hit that push to talk. Very well. The public has said what it says. Thanks to everyone who participated tonight. Hope you'll come back next Sunday when we try and do it all over again. I'll be back a little bit later, but I guess we'll Paul, give us the SpaceNet report.
Okay. Yeah, we can do that. WS2N for the SpaceNet report. Not a heck of a lot new going on, but I'd like to do some of the follow-up stories that we've done in the past. Maybe a couple of recent events. you have 7 people on board the International Space Station right now. Correction, 9 people. Normally have 7, but now we have 9 because the 2 people are still on the space station that came up with Starliner. And they're not going home anytime soon until Boeing and NASA get a lot more data from the problems with the reaction control jets on the Starliner. There's about 60 of them, I think 62 total. But they've had problems with 5 of them. They got 4 working. There's one that they just shut down altogether. But these are all designed, hooked up to computers. So when they're maneuvering in space, like docking, the jets might fire hundreds of times, readjusting the spacecraft as it goes into the docking. So apparently they think that maybe some of them are firing too much, and they start to overheat, and there's limit. I guess probably the misters or something that tell the software to shut down certain jets. But anyway, you know, they're up there with 7 other people. One of the people is Jeanette Epps, another astronaut. She's been up there quite a few months already, and you know, they went up on a Falcon 9. And, you know, part of the regular crew now. Let me drop it. Okay, and she has a ham radio license, KF5 QNU. And last week she got to make contact via amateur radio to Morocco, Casablanca, Morocco. There's students there. They use the telebridge system. So they transmit down to a telebridge, which might be located, let's say, in Italy. And we have another one in California. And I think there's another one up in Finland. Anyway, there's telebridge locations around the globe that NASA uses for telebridge contacts. You know, she'll transmit down to the telebridge. The telebridge will send that transmission, you know, via cable and through satellites, whatever, through the phone lines to the school system. The school system gets to ask their 10 or 12 questions, and that's how they communicate back and forth. But if they ever go overhead and they're transmitting, for instance, they come over to New York, which is quite a bit, and they're actually transmitting on their 2-meter rig, your frequency you would listen to is 145.800. megahertz, so 2 meters. And I did this many years ago when I first started there. It wasn't with the space station, but it was with the space shuttle. And it was STS-45. It was Atlantis. They were going overhead, and I got to hear them. And I was trying with my 2-meter rig, but you know, there were so many people. There was such a pile up. Anyway, if you got a chance to hear them back in those days, you would just send in to NASA. You would send the time and the call letters that you heard them talking to, and if you filled out that information, you'd send them a QSL card. They send you a QSL card back, which I have one hanging on the wall with a picture of the crew of STS-45. But you know, the frequency hasn't changed, 145.800. So any time I get a 2-meter rig, I naturally use that as one of the memories. Any comments before I move on?
This is Kilo Echo 2, Alpha Juliet Uniform. How are you, Paul?
Good evening, Charlie. How are you doing? We're here again. Sunday night. Any comments, Charlie?
Yes. About how much food does the International Space Station have on hand now?
Did you say how much room? Is that what you said?
How much food?
food. They have months of supply up there, and they keep getting more up there. You know, naturally it doesn't last. They have bags of liquid. They have freeze dried stuff that they actually heat up. They have a toaster oven type of thing. I don't know if they ever bought a microwave up. I guess they probably did over time, but they have a lot of food for the 9 people that are up there for probably a couple of months. Now what happens is as that dwindles down, every supply cargo vehicle that goes up, and there's been a number of them, over the years. Now right now we have the Dragon cargo vehicle that brings up, maybe 5,000 pounds of stuff every time that goes up. We have Cygnus cargo vehicle. When that goes up, that brings up more weight, maybe about 7,500 pounds of stuff, supplies, food, clothes, But, there's always food going up. Progress vehicle from Russia, it looks almost exactly like the Soyuz spacecraft that they go up in, but this one is a cargo vehicle, and they bring about 6,000 pounds every time they go up. There's been a couple of them that don't go up there anymore over the years. I think Wes said that they started around 2000, so here we are 24 years later, and those cargo vehicles that don't go up anymore that are retired. Let me drop it. One is called the HTV, and that was by Japan, and that used to go up once a year. They made 9 trips to the space station. Now that thing was much larger, quite big, and that would probably bring up 10,000 pounds of stuff. And then the one bigger than that was something called the ATV. And the ATV was by the European Space Agency. And that used to launch on the Ariane 5 rocket from French Guiana and down in South America. The European Space Agency sent that. And they made made 5 trips up to the space station. And each one that went up had a different name. It was really a large vehicle, and I used to dock with the Russian portion of the space station. And by the way, the Japanese one that I was just talking about, HTV, they were in a process of building a new one, and bigger and better, that not only will supply the International Space Station, but will also supply the Gateway Space Station, whenever they put that into lunar orbit. So that will bring up, clothes, science, and, of course, food. And the food is really good from, from the early days. They used to squeeze food out of the look like a toothpaste tube to what they have today. They have really good food up there. Anyway, back to you, Charlie, WS2N.
There was one thing I wanted to bring up last week, but we didn't have enough time. The Voyager 1 is back online. How'd they do that?
Yeah, what is it? Last November is when they had the problem, and they had to figure out what it was. They was, it was sending back gibberish. They realized something was fouled up. The computers just on board Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. And they knew something was wrong because they didn't understand that what they were getting back. They were still receiving signals. It was still pointing in the right direction. They used something called dead reckoning. You might use a code or Charles Lindbergh used getting from Ozone
Field.
Radio on board. Something called Deborah. Look at the winds, the way it's going, and the Russian. And the stay in that. That's the way the Voyager works. while they, you know, might fly the thrusters, you know, once in a blue moon to, like, correct it. It's self-correcting, by the way. It looks at the signal coming from Earth, and there's like a hole in the dish. They have like this 12-foot dish looking back at Earth. There's a hole in the center of it. And it picks up that signal, and if something changes, you know, it'll make an adjustment, make sure that the dish is always pointing back to Earth.